Hey, everybody. Why don't we close out the week? You know, it's Friday. Let's do one more show, I guess. And let's make it a fun one. So, to do that, Emma's here. Emma Vigeland.
Oh, your other shows aren't fun? Only when I'm on?
No, only this time. Even the previous one you were on wasn't that great.
Everyone unsubscribe.
But this one should be. Exactly. No, stay. No, this one should be fun because we have a lot to talk about. I mean, not only do we have some of the fallout from yesterday's introduction of the Green New Deal resolution. As we speak, Matthew Whitaker, the acting AG, is being grilled, I guess. I don't know. He's reacting as if he's being grilled. I don't think the questions are that hard, but he's not up to the task. And then we also have a couple of awesome guests going to be joining us. So Nomi Constant is going to be giving us an update on the race for the New York City public advocate position. And then later on, Brian Unger, friend of the show, you might know from The Daily Show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, a number of different shows. He's going to be joining us to talk about Donald Trump's physical, as well as the latest on the Jeff Bezos ever-evolving scandal too. So a lot that we're gonna be talking about.
Excited, let's get to it.
Oh, okay, in that case we will. Okay. Yesterday we had the introduction of the Green New Deal resolution. We broke down some of the details on it, some of the initial, I guess, response to it being put forward. And one aspect of that was that Nancy Pelosi said something that I interpreted as quite condescending about it. When she said to Politico, the green dream or whatever they call it, everybody seems to support it even though they don't know what's in it, effectively she said. So that seemed insulting considering that this has, you know, not only just massive approval from most people, including a majority of Republicans, but virtually every presidential contender in the Democratic primary has signed on to it to say the green dream or whatever.
And to pretend like you don't know what it is. I mean, if she is really that out of touch, that's very concerning because the Green New Deal has been a topic on a variety of cable shows, stuff she might be watching on Twitter. People have been talking about it. She's got to know, as the head of the House, that the most popular and most dynamic member of the House is proposing such bold legislation, especially when it's in her own caucus.
Yeah.
So it's flippant and also dishonest.
Yeah, I mean, so my girlfriend pointed out that later in that same interview, she did use the term Green New Deal. So
why say that initially?
So why say, who has ever said blank, 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 or whatever they call it, and meant anything other than go F yourself to that thing?
Yeah.
That's just what that means. That's what that linguistic construct is designed to accomplish. So, okay, but that's my interpretation. I don't know Nancy Pelosi, never spoken to Nancy Pelosi, I've barely spoken to AOC. Let's see what they talk, what they say about this. So on the introduction of the bill, we have an updated comment from the speaker. She said, frankly, I haven't seen it, but I do know it's enthusiastic and I welcome all the enthusiasm.
But not the policies, which scare me.
Yes, that's true. And again, you can't look at every bill. This one's 14 pages. I feel like you could have.
Yeah.
You could have, like, it's got dozens and dozens and dozens of co-sponsors among your caucus. It seems weird not to flip through it.
Yeah, I mean, especially because we hear a lot of talk from her about how climate change is an existential threat and that she really listened to the Sunrise Movement protesters when they stormed her office. But unfortunately, she hasn't really shown to be a leader on climate, which is what Ocasio-Cortez called her in a quote defending Nancy Pelosi. But I almost love that Ocasio-Cortez is doing it because she has such a microscope on her and is so influential that alienating Nancy Pelosi, she's playing politics, which I like to see her do, right? So that she is proving that she can kind of make friends with the Democratic Party, but still act in the way that we would want her to on the substance of the legislation. Because, you know, sometimes I feel like people that like watch our shows or comment are like, they're like, she needs to fight harder. She needs to slam Nancy Pelosi. No. She's got to work with her every day and she's basically her boss. So.
Yeah, and we're going to have a little bit of that. But you did, you mentioned the Sunrise Movement. That was another thing where like, you really want us to believe you don't know what this is called. Like the push for it was launched, like, I don't know for sure, but that's probably your door right
it
there.
It is her door.
That's
yeah,
your door.
That's her door.
Or on the other side, I don't know. It's one of the doors. You know who she is, you know the movement. She referred to them as the Sunny D movement or whatever they call them. No, I'm kidding. She knows it. I'm sure she knows what the name of the group is.
She doesn't even know what Sunny D is.
Exactly. I barely do anymore. So asked about this, AOC said, No, I think it is a green dream. I don't consider that to be a dismissive term. Nancy Pelosi is a leader on climate, has always been a leader on climate, and I will not allow our caucus to be divided up by silly notions of whatever narrative. We are in this together. So that is her. She is diplomatic.
That is diplomatic.
I can't get in her brain.
That
I'm not
is
a telepath.
Not true. I mean, she knows that's not true, but good for her. Like, again, yeah. I mean, she is already a really talented politician. And not just in articulating ideas that are incredibly important, but in just ingratiating herself to the caucus, which is a part of the job. I know that it sucks, but it's a part of the job.
Yeah, and there's versions of what you just saw there that could be really self-defeating, like people who would say something like that and then not actually fight back,
right,
not actually protest outside of her office or whatever. I think she is a good mix of the both. And she's the sort of progressive that I like, where it's the exact opposite of that sort of knee-jerk, like, if a name comes up, I'm gonna find something bad they did and I'm gonna tell them to go F themselves again. Like, some people feel that sort of contrarian knee-jerk thing and want to see that in other people. Like, you know what I like about AOC, I like about Bernie? They're not a-holes. That's what I like about them. They're progressives, they're strong, they fight, they're smart, they're right on the issues. They're not dicks.
Yeah, and I would say even Ocasio-Cortez is better at not being an a-hole as
well,
Bernie
is.
Well,
he's gruff, certainly.
Because Bernie's tough, right?
But Bernie doesn't take cheap, just blah.
Oh, no.
Like, shots at people.
Because he has literally one mode, and it's just like, hi, I'm Bernie Sanders. The millionaires and billionaires is
exactly
the same talking point every single time.
Yeah.
She, you know, is a little bit more cool in that sense. Not saying you're not cool, Bernie. I love you too.
But it's like you walk up to Bernie and he's just like, he's got statistics he's waiting to tell you about income inequality. It's like when I walk up to people talking, I'm like, when can I mention Quidditch? I'm just waiting for my opportunity, my window.
The answer is never, John.
No,
the
I'd like to.
The answer is never.
I would like to. So one other little bit of potential conflict between the speaker and AOC had to do with the creation of that select committee on climate change, which did not have AOC on it, which I interpret it as, I mean, that seems like an unnecessary slight, but either I'm wrong or more diplomacy. Ocasio-Cortez and Pelosi separately told reporters that the speaker had invited Ocasio-Cortez to join the select committee on climate change, but she had declined because she had other committee commitments. She also suggested she was more interested in working on legislative solutions to climate change rather than the investigative work Castor's committee will be tasked with.
I don't know.
Okay. That is very diplomatic and also potentially true. I don't want to call anyone a liar, but
everyone
it
lies.
Seems important.
No,
I don't know.
Look, I mean, she's going above and beyond to make sure that she's not alienating the rest of the caucus. I just hope that they return the favor and treat her with the same respect that she is treating Nancy Pelosi.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you begin holding your breath. And we're gonna see what color Emma turns next.
I will be dead by by the next segment.
Yeah.
Segment.
We'll see. Okay. So lots more to get to. We're gonna take our break just a little bit early here. On the other side of this, Nomi Counts is gonna join us. Break down New York City's public advocate race. The latest on that. It's coming up in just a few weeks, and we'll be talking about that after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. It has been a little while, and for that reason, I am very happy to welcome back to the show a friend of the show, Nomi Kantz. Nomi, welcome back to the Narrative Report.
Hello!
How's it going? Whoa, you're coming with a lot of energy there.
Oh, yeah, I've been living off of coffee and adrenaline for the last 4 months.
I've got some of that too. There's something weird about the image, though. I don't see one Nomi, I see many Nomis.
My God, I know it's painful.
So you are running as a candidate for a New York City public advocate. That race is now just a few weeks from closing. It ends on the 26th, correct?
Yes, we are. The election's on February 26th. I'm going to say that 9,000 times to our viewers in New York. February 26th, same polling place, because it's a very unusual election. It's a special election in the middle of winter, although it doesn't feel like winter. We're expecting incredibly low turnout, which is great for us because our base is mobilized and energized and educated, and it could really come down to, you know, a few friends here and there and maybe like a family.
So I know that we've talked about this before, but just in case there are new viewers who aren't familiar with the position of public advocate, why is that an important role inside of New York?
Yeah, so the public advocate is the second most powerful office in the city, although the budget isn't as large. It is second in line to the mayor. It is the watchdog of the city. The office is there to make sure that New York City government, all its agencies, the mayor, the city council are all doing their jobs and making sure that everybody in New York has a voice, not just the special interests, not just the real estate developers who have a very, very loud voice in the city, and of course, not the political institutions.
So there has been some media attention put onto the race, and recently the New York Post did a write-up on the different candidates. There are many, I believe 17 at this point. How would you rate the seriousness with which they took your candidacy in that write-up?
Okay, so this is hilarious because yes, there are 17 people on the ballot, but they're actually going to be, there were 10 people in the debate, which was 2 days ago. And 10 in the debate are, you know, for lack of better words, the front runners. Those who've raised enough money to be viable, those who've been able to get their message out and mobilize support. Some people have been able to do that weren't on the stage. It's a little bit of a pay-to-play scheme, but the New York Post, just a couple of days before, wrote this piece like, these are the quirky candidates in the race. And frankly, I was lumped in with folks that, you know, are not on the debate stage. I was on the debate stage. I qualified. We've raised, you know, over $125,000 at this point. We have hundreds of supporters and volunteers. We submitted 10,000 signatures to get on the petition, to get on the ballot. And they lumped us in with the quirky candidates. And they said that I was an actress in a low budget movie. Now, what they're referring to, which just shows the quality of reporting here on this hit piece, they're referring to a campaign ad I did for a friend over 10 years ago, in which it was a mock ad of Republicans and it went viral. I literally appear in it for 2 seconds. It's called I'm Voting Republican. And it's like, I'm voting Republican because, you know, who wants a clean environment? Who believes in labor standards? It's a parody. So that's what they just erased my entire history, my entire resume. And you know, we proved them wrong because we won the debate. We were able to, we got the most positive response from the debate. We had just as much airtime as the Speaker of the City Council, former Speaker, whose response online was negative. We got the most tweets by far, as opposed to anybody else. And the New York Times barely mentioned us the next day. We had some of the most explosive moments. It's very clear that the press is scared of having somebody take on the economic model of the city, taking on the developers, taking on the politicians on stage who are really bought off by these folks. And it doesn't mean that we're going to stop. We're just going to keep plugging away. And hitting matching funds is a big deal because when you hit matching funds in the city, you can now compete with the people who are funded by the millionaires and billionaires with small dollar donations, which are multiplied by eight, basically.
And it's amazing that New York actually has that system. It's the sort of thing that seems like it'd be good to see tested in a lot more different corners of America. I do have a question about, so you have a debate with 10 candidates. on the stage. You have 17 potential candidates that people could be voting for. So when you have that many different people, how does that shape your strategy?
Great question. You know, New York politics is tricky. To add to this, this is a very unusual campaign, possibly one of the weirdest elections in the history of the country. Even Dave Weigel from the Washington Post said that a couple of days ago. He said this is the weirdest election. Because on top of this all, it's a nonpartisan election. So Republicans can vote in this election, independents can vote in this election, and I think that it really comes down to who can mobilize their base the best, who can excite people the most, who can get their message out and really activate folks. Some people in this race are competing for the same base. They're competing for the same demographics, the same regions. What I'll say is I am the only millennial woman in this race. I am the only in the top 10 candidates, I should say. I'm the only person who is not taking developer money. I'm the only person who doesn't take, you know, with that corporate money, lobbyist money, charter school money. You know, we are a very small dollar driven campaign. And so distinguishing myself is actually a little bit easier than I'd say some of the other folks because, you know, they're all politicians. They're from similar neighborhoods, similar messages, similar backgrounds. My background is I've actually been a watchdog. Mm-hmm. Literally nobody in this race has been a watchdog. In the actual charter of New York City, it says that this is the ombudsman position. That's a really wonky term, but I was an ombudsperson on the DNC Unity Reform Commission. So of all the people running, I'm the only one calling for the public advocate to be removed from the succession to the mayor. I'm the only one who's taking on the developers and taxing them. I am the only socialist in the race. So I think that we have a very clear path because not only is this our base that really we're not competing with anybody else, but it's the base that got AOC elected. It's the base that took on all those IDC, the IDC members who are holding up our government. It's what got, you look at who's won in the last year in New York, who's beaten the establishment, they're millennial progressive women. And I'm the only one in this race.
No, Miki, are you suggesting that the... Hey, I know, maybe a surprise. Are you suggesting that the New York Post framing of you and the leaving out of your history with the DNC and your past electoral history might have to do with their right-wing framing?
A little bit of the right-wing framing. I also think that they're sexist, too. I mean, it's hard to know which... They're basically both. And it's not just New York Post. Everybody's doing it. All the reporters in the mainstream press are pretending we don't exist. They're pretending that we're not hitting matching funds. They're pretending that we weren't on the debate stage. You got to watch this debate because it's very hard to pretend that I wasn't there. Mm-hmm.
So if anyone's watching this and they want to see that debate, if they want to get involved in the last weeks of the election, what happens between now and the 26th?
So from now until the 26th, we have a big deadline on the 11th. It's the last deadline to hit matching funds. What that means is if you're a New York resident, your dollar gets matched by another $8, but we don't receive that money until we hit their threshold. Mm-hmm. And we are extremely close, just a couple thousand dollars away from hitting the threshold. And then once we hit that, the city will give us all that money. And then we can mobilize folks, hire organizers, put out press, possibly even buy an ad in an election like this. That might make a difference. I don't want to say that, but, you know, at least digitally we can buy ads. It's really old fashioned, you know, door knocking that's going to get us elected. But it's going to really come down to, are we able to blanket 8 million people across 5 boroughs? So that's the first thing that's happening in the near future. We have another debate on February 20th. I believe that we'll have qualified for that at that point. So stay tuned on February 20th for that debate. And in the meantime, you know, we have an event, a big concert. If you're in New York, we have a huge concert with Josh Fox and Ra Ra Riot on Sunday at the Chelsea Music Hall. You can go to our website. You can go to my Instagram, Nomi Kikonst, and you know, buy tickets there and meet me in person if you like. But we are going to be, we're looking for volunteers. We're going to be mobilizing on the street. You know, DM me on Twitter, message me. I'm very involved in communicating with folks. You can also just go to our website and sign up to volunteer. But the election's on February 26th. It's really about getting the word out and telling your friends and family, if you live in New York, to chip in a few bucks. Obviously, we'll accept money from anywhere, but it really is matched if you live in New York.
Well, Nomi, obviously, good luck in the election. We're going to be watching, and thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you, guys. I miss you.
Thank you. Miss you, too.
Miss you. Bye.
We'll see you soon. Bye. We're gonna take just a short break. We come back a little bit more. The Whitaker hearing continues. We're gonna see the latest on that. We've got a big decision from the Supreme Court. Lots more to get to. Stick around. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Now we turn to Matthew Whitaker and the evolving saga over what he will actually say as he's being grilled in Congress. Now, initially, he didn't want to actually come in and testify. And then they threatened to subpoena him. And then he said, okay, I'll go, but only if you take away the threat to subpoena me. I don't even know. That seems like a rhetorical thing at that point. In any event, he went in there. Now, that does not mean he's going to answer many questions, because he's found some ingenious responses when questions he doesn't like are put to him. Take a look at this back and forth.
In your capacity as acting attorney general, have you ever been asked to approve any request or action to be taken by the special counsel?
Mr. Chairman, I see that your 5 minutes is up, and so I'm... I'm here voluntarily. We have agreed to 5 minute rounds. And
the committee,
I think that's a fine place to end the 5 minute rule.
The committee will come to order. I will point out that we didn't enforce the 5 minute rule on acting Attorney General Whitaker. We will.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. I was just saying that might be a good breaking point at that point for you.
No, the Attorney General was in the middle of saying something.
That's the question.
Answer the question, please.
Regular order.
I do not think I've ever heard someone being talked to in Congress that just said, no, your time's up, dude.
I've never seen someone be so smug. Mm-hmm. Do you think his lies are as bald face as his bald head?
I don't know. I just think there's such a great, I think this is still up. I don't know if it's still there, but check his Twitter, because I'm pretty sure it's him like pumping iron, like super hardcore. But don't ask me any tough questions, because then I'm gonna zip and zag out of the way. You're not gonna be able to catch me. You're not gonna be able to pin me.
He's a super tough guy.
Yeah, are you a tough guy? You're not a tough guy. Jerry Nadler's asked you the question. He barely was able to get through the question, and you can't answer it.
Yeah, I don't understand. I just don't understand what this kind of approach accomplishes. You look like a complete thug, other than the fact that he's probably ingratiating himself to Donald Trump with these kinds of answers, which. Like a lot of these public testimonies and, you know, are ways for employees of Donald Trump to prove to him how loyal they are. And this seems to be one of those instances.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. Now, he did answer in that response why he wanted them to, okay, I'll come, but you have to not threaten me. Like, that way he can say I'm here voluntarily. I guess technically.
Yeah, it's like a distinction without difference, because if you're already coming, why would it matter if they were attempting to subpoena you?
Yeah. Yeah, now, we have a couple of extra points, because I know what you're thinking. Why should I care about his testimony? I don't have an amazing answer for you. I mean, obviously, he's been invested with a great deal of power. Attorney General, acting or otherwise, that is one of the most important positions in our government. And it was given to that guy, face alone, not qualified for that position, not qualified to wear a suit. But he's doing it and he has that power. So the reason possibly that this matters is that when you get people like Matthew Whitaker to testify like this under oath, what you then can do eventually is when it's revealed that they're lying, because for some reason, not connected to any criminal wrongdoing, they all lie about these topics. He might eventually have to go before Robert Mueller over these. So here are some of the things that were mentioned during this testimony. Kyle Griffin noted, save this for the future. Matthew Whitaker says that he has not talked to Trump or senior White House officials about the special counsel's investigation. So Matthew Whitaker said that. I don't know how that is possible. Matthew Whitaker, before getting the position, was known for, I think, two things. One, working for an incredibly shady patent company. And two, publicly advocating nonstop for the investigation to be shut down.
And three, being the strength and conditioning coach for the Minnesota Vikings.
Exactly. He did a good job there. I didn't have a problem with him there. Really turned them around. But yeah, the idea... Maybe they haven't talked. Maybe Trump has learned that he's not supposed to get involved in this investigation. Maybe he is trying not to commit obstruction of justice again. That is possible. I find it hard to believe, but anyway, that's what Matthew Whitaker went on the record saying. Also this, Whitaker, after not answering the question several times about whether he discussed his concerns on special counsel's investigations with the White House when he was a private citizen, finally says, no, I did not. So he didn't like further vocalize his concerns about it, I guess. And Manu Raju also says, this is not going to be Whitaker's last time before the House Judiciary Committee. He will return for a closed door transcribed a deposition on topics he refused to answer, according to Nadler. So I guess at the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily matter if the 5 minutes are up. He is going to be brought back to answer some of those questions.
Yeah, so it's all about, again, as I mentioned before, the optics of it. So he gets to be a strong man, say your 5 minutes are up. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe that's just the kind of guy that he is, but it's also the kind of thing that Donald Trump would really like. That's what he wanted all along, was an attorney general who was completely loyal to him and to his own interests and would not be like someone who would fall apart or give any information to Mueller or anything like that. So there you go.
Yeah, well, we'll be watching, see what Donald Trump says about it. I'm sure he will comment. He's been on a tear since early this morning about the investigation and all that. And we will see how Mr. Clinton did in the end. Okay, with that, let's turn to the Supreme Court. Yesterday, the Supreme Court blocked a Louisiana law from going into effect that would have eliminated most of the very few number of doctors that are permitted in the state to administer abortions. They would have been down to just one after this. The vote was 5-4, and Chief Justice John Roberts joined liberals on the court to stop that law from going into effect. Now, this is not the end of the legal process for that law. This is just one step along the way, but it is interesting for a couple of reasons. The first is that John Roberts did join the libs on the court. The other is that you had Clarence Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh against it. They would have denied the stay. They would have let the law go into effect. Only Kavanaugh published a dissent.
He tried to
be a little bit nuanced in it, but remember, of the concerns we had about Kavanaugh, the biggest ones were probably that sure seemed like he was harassing and assaulting women. But beyond that, and his drinking issues, and the fact that he apparently is going to enter the court in the most partisan fashion that I've ever seen, he also, we worry, wants to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Yes.
And now we have this, and he not only votes to allow this bill that it doesn't seem like, based on Supreme Court precedent, we'll go into that, should have been allowed in the first place, but writes the dissent for it.
And women's issues in general, the fact that he chose to write a dissent about this. Okay, you're on the court already, do whatever you want, man. But yeah, that seems to be a questionable decision. And also what's disturbing is that women's rights and reproductive health hinges on the opinions of Chief Justice Roberts, who is not a liberal. He's not even close to one. He's a conservative. But since Kennedy's departure, he has become the swing vote, and he's already blocked a variety of measures which were trying to limit reproductive rights. So we're hanging by a thread based on John Roberts.
Yeah.
Yay.
Exactly. And this could be a preview of what's going to happen in the future. I will promise that I will only do this about 100 times more. But when I'm looking at those who voted against it, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, that's four. Could have been two.
Could have been two.
Could have been two if Donald Trump wasn't president. So, I mean, we like to point out good news when it happens. We're really excited about some politicians. We think we're going to have a really raucous, productive primary process. But even if that happens, and even if we get the exact candidate we want, and even if that candidate goes on to win the presidency in 2020, they will be facing an incredibly hostile, durable conservative majority in the Supreme Court that never should have gotten there and wouldn't have if Donald Trump hadn't become president.
But she was a shill.
That's true. She was. By the way, I want to go over just one more second, because Kavanaugh's not the only one I'm pissed at. I'm pissed at Susan Collins, too. You might recall her saying this in her big speech explaining why she was going to support Kavanaugh. She said, there has also been considerable focus on the future of abortion rights based on the concern that Judge Kavanaugh would seek to overturn Roe v. Wade. Protecting this right is important to me. To my knowledge, Judge Kavanaugh is the first Supreme Court nominee to express the view that precedent is not merely a practice and tradition, but rooted in Article 3 of our Constitution itself. He believes that precedent is not just a judicial policy, it is constitutionally dictated to pay attention and pay heed to rules of precedent. In other words, precedent isn't a goal or an aspiration, it is a constitutional tenet that has to be followed except in the most extraordinary circumstances.
BS.
BS. And you know what, Susan Collins? We found those extraordinary circumstances. We must have, because he would have allowed this law to go into effect, even though it is virtually identical to a law that was struck down by the Supreme Court in Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt just 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So precedent important for the first 12 to 16 months.
And
after that,
he overturned precedent as an appeals judge. It is so, so sanctimonious and annoying. Like every Supreme Court nominee, they all say that they are believers in precedent. Mm-hmm. They're all political actors. It doesn't matter anymore. We are not living in the 1700s where they don't have access to the news and cable news and they see what's going on in the political sphere. They act accordingly. Stop pretending otherwise. It's insulting to our intelligence.
Exactly. And get Susan Collins out of there if we can, America. Okay, with that, we are going to take a break. We come back. Brian Unger is going to be joining us. Very excited for that. Stick around. Very excited to welcome to the show our next guest. You've probably seen him on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, How the States Got Their Shapes, The Daily Show, a number of different programs. Welcome back to the show, Brian Unger.
It is so great to be on with you this morning. How's it going over there at the Damage Report?
It is. It's pretty good here. You know, not a huge news day, but we're very excited to have you here.
Hi there.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. This is great.
This is so lovely. We're all so polite.
Well, let's see if that maintains throughout the rest of the.
we'll see how this goes.
A few things I want to talk about. I wanted to start off with Jeff Bezos because it was already an interesting, ongoing, ever-evolving story. And then we had his Medium post where he describes how he was doing this investigation as to how some of his private texts had been acquired and then leaked. And apparently he was approached by the parent company of the National Enquirer and threatened to drop his investigation or else more nude photos would be released. And he decided not to do that and he publicized the entire thing. What was your reaction to this?
I don't know, I'm reminded over and over again is like, don't videotape yourself having sex. Don't take a picture of your member, your organ, your whatever and transmit that electronically to anyone. It will be found. And we've known this since the age of, by the way, videotape, since like say VHS tapes. And wherever you are on the spectrum, let's say, like if you're an R. Kelly, hey, that's gonna get seen eventually. Yeah. If you're, I'm not saying Jeff Bezos is R. Kelly. I just wanna be very, very clear about that.
Good,
but if there were an axe to grind, it would be Jeff Bezos being just a total pebble in the shoe of Donald Trump perpetually. And I think he would like nothing else than to sic his people on him and make his life miserable. So is it plausible? Yeah, I think someone in the government may have hacked his stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I do see a lot of talk about that. And I mean, it's possible if he continues his investigation that we could find out more about that. We also know that if AMI was breaking the law, that seems like it would be bad to begin with, but it also would break their non-prosecution agreement with the Robert Mueller team. They were supposed to stop breaking the law when they signed on with that. And so it's just interesting to speculate about what could end up happening from this story. Was there an ongoing partnership between someone in government and AMI to protect
them? Is this a story of like two journalistic titans going head to head?
I don't know. Now, sort of floating around this story, though, is the fact that a lot of people, even if they're scared about what this might represent from the National Enquirer or the possibility the government could be involved, nobody or very few people want to feel sympathy towards Jeff Bezos. He's one of the wealthiest people in the history of the planet.
Now, why is that? Now, why don't we feel sympathy? Is it just because he's so grotesquely wealthy? Is that it?
Well, also he's shown like not much consideration for privacy rights for human rights himself until he was forced into raising the wages of his employees. So I think that has influenced the response. But I would say you can have believe in those ideals and also feel bad for Jeff Bezos in this particular situation because it's a gross invasion of privacy and being blackmailed, it's nuts. Mm-hmm.
I think this is a classic case of a nerd who became wildly rich and then fell for a local news anchor. This happens in every town.
A tale as old as time. I think we could help to avoid situations like this. I know it's difficult, but I feel like we should have a blanket policy, and let me know if you agree or not, that unless there is an illegal act or a child involved, when someone's nude photos are released, just support that person.
Yeah.
So that people don't have to be scared about this stuff coming out. I think that would be a good development for society.
Also interesting how the reaction to this from the general public is different from the reaction when, say, Jennifer Lawrence's pictures were leaked. Women are treated with more derision when things like that happens, as opposed to men who don't.
It's funny, because this is one of the, you're right, Emma, and this, John, this falls into that weird sort of like, in one category, this story doesn't matter and nobody cares at all. Like, really, it's not as if he's elected to public office, and it's not like he's your minister in your local town. He's just a rich guy who has some nude photos that will eventually be out there. You know, they're in the ether, they'll probably be published at some point. I think it only gets weird is like, what if there is some clandestine sort of like hacking thing going on where then you have, if you take the Amazon part out of it, he's the kind of the publisher of a national newspaper. And so then it becomes an attack on the press, in intimidation and extortion and all of that stuff. So it could easily tip into that territory and be very serious, or it could just be like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, we need good journalism more than ever. So my plea, I guess, to the companies that are still doing that, their leadership is don't take pictures of your private parts, because I don't want you getting blackmailed in the future.
I mean, isn't that really it in the end? Like, just, I don't know, you know, go online and look at porn. Don't make your own.
Well, then okay. Who would make the porn?
That's a lesson for us all. That's true. Well, some people, it's their career. So there's much more important news that I do want to make sure that we get to. And that is that today, possibly as we speak, Donald Trump is receiving his presidential physical. And despite his best efforts, Ronny Jackson is not going to be conducting it. This is the doctor who said that he's in very, very good health, excellent health. I'd put him in the highest category and all of that. So we might get an honest physical. Will this be the thing that takes down Donald Trump?
You know, whatever the results are, I will file them away with and or perceive them with the same credibility that Donald Trump's take, whatever his take is on climate change, the efficacy of border walls, I don't know, computer hacking. I mean, I'm not sure why we as a country should accept his science when he won't accept anyone else's.
Yeah. So. I think the government reported BMI for Donald Trump is a hoax created by the Chinese.
I mean, listen. So, let's just call it like it is.
Yeah.
This man is obese.
And you know what? A lot of Americans are. So
that's right.
He represents
and I'm not getting
America.
Down on, you know, I find myself in this culture now where we have to apologize to everyone before as we say something. But Donald Trump's gigantic.
Yeah, and look, I honestly think that he could use that fact to start a conversation about American food safety, access to healthy food and all that, but I don't expect that will actually happen. I have one more question for you. We're gonna go over a little bit for this. Donald Trump, he launched us into the shutdown. It appears to have been a disaster for him. Multiple polls, including Morning Consult and also Rasmussen, show that January was his worst month ever for approval. And so I'm curious, from your point of view, have we entered sort of a new phase for Donald Trump where he no longer has the sort of unified control of government that he did? He doesn't necessarily have the influence to turn things around for him. Do you think that this might be a point of no return for his power, or will he find a way to bounce back?
I think, are you asking me if there was a tipping point? And I would say the tipping point was probably a couple of weeks ago. I do think that, you know, I always liken America to sort of like passengers on a plane at 30,000 feet. And after a while, everybody gets sick of the turbulence and wants it to stop, wants to get off the plane. And I think kind of like, you know, the center of America, I'm not talking about the 83% of Republicans who still approve of him, want the ride to be over. Mm-hmm. And I think we're just going to have to like know and be sort of just kind of okay with a turbulent ride for the next couple of years until this thing ends. Just because of the noise and instability and all of it is really an annoying thing. you know, if you really look at it from a high altitude. So yeah, I think you're right. I think this is kind of the we're watching the gradual unraveling. And I don't know, I say that maybe with too much confidence, maybe, because that's kind of a gut thing I have from having grown up in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. But you know, even my mom's Republican card playing friends, you know, are they don't even want to talk about him anymore, and they just want it to be over.
Okay, well, that's perhaps a positive note to the end of week on. Brian Unger, as always, thank you for joining us.
That wasn't terribly funny either, but it was just my.
It does not have to be. Okay, you can be insightful.
I love
too.
You guys. Keep fighting the fight.
Thank you.
We need you.
Thank you, and you as well. And so, have a good weekend, Brian.
Thanks. You too. Bye.
We're gonna take a short break. We come back. One more story for you to close out the week. After this. So I could make the case to you that Tucker Carlson is an idiot, but I'll let him do it instead. Here he is.
Ask any waiter how well progressives tip. Seriously, ask a waiter. A group of progressive activists arrives at a restaurant. They linger for hours delivering passionate lectures about the horrors of income inequality. When they leave, they shaft the working people who've served them food, the very people they claim to care about. Only with progressivism is this behavior possible. Precisely because they care so much about structural inequality, progressives don't have to leave actual cash on an actual table for actual workers. Their tip is their profound sense of caring. Too bad waiters can't pay the rent with that.
What? What?
What is any of that? Is that like a challenge? Like, hey, Tucker, bet you can't do a segment on how libs don't tip good.
You know how I get paid? You know how I get paid here at TYT? With profound senses of caring.
Hey, no, can you pay your rent with that?
No.
Yeah, you know what they can pay the rent with? A higher minimum wage, you jackass, which you oppose.
That is an unbelievable segment, and it's just like a case study in how Fox News, it's all about this narrative of liberals just kind of infecting the culture and changing things that they love. And it's all working backwards from their conclusion, mm-hmm. which is that very thing.
What I don't get is, I don't get how he came up with the topic, other than I want to demonize libs. I don't get, how much research do you think he did? So he said, and on the lower third, it said, seriously, ask a waiter how they get tipped. Do you think he did? Do you think he went down to a restaurant and asked someone? I was a waiter. I waited tables at multiple restaurants in multiple cities over multiple years. So I'm an expert on this. And I can't tell you if libs or conservatives tip better. You know why? Because why would I know what their politics is? I'm serving them curry. I'm not talking to them about basic income.
Yeah,
How would you know?
Well, is it like a tinily racial thing?
Maybe it's a racial thing. But he seems to be specifically lampooning progressives who like theoretically want things but won't actually throw a coin on the table.
No, it's
probably racist. It is Tucker Carlson.
But what bothers me is that it's actually kind of part of their overall argument, which is that Bernie Sanders can't talk about socialism and raising taxes when he's wearing a $300 jacket, or mm-hmm. they have such difficulty separating individual actions from policy, or they're purposely conflating the two, which mm-hmm. is so insidious and frustrating.
Yeah, so a couple examples of that leap to mind. I saw recently, you might have tweeted about this. It was Elizabeth Warren says she wants a wealth tax, but she's a millionaire. Okay, well then hypothetically she's okay with the tax being on her too. How does that undercut her argument? It buttresses it. It shows that she's a moral person willing to be affected by the consequences of her policies.
FDR.
So here's the thing, Emma. You and I, we care about climate change, right?
Yes.
We would like to do something about climate change, but we can't. Because we've been on planes, and so we have no moral authority.
That's exactly
it. If you fly on a plane, you must acquit.
Yep.
They really think that that is a persuasive thing, that Al Gore, for instance, sure, he rallied a generation to care about climate change, but he flew Southwest once. This is what passes for persuasion. I wish that we had more time. I wish I could explain to you how you're not allowed to be pro-choice if you say that you're a democratic socialist. He literally tried to make that argument. Unfortunately, we don't have time. Thank you for joining me on the show. It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much, John. Yeah,
let's have that more happen more often.
I agree.
And you can watch her on Rebel HQ.
Yes, please do.
And thank you to everybody who's been watching throughout the week. Next week, we've got Ro Khanna, a bunch of other awesome guests gonna be joining us. Lots to get to. I will see you Monday morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.